Meet Sven.
Yeah.
He's very excited right now. Sven doesn't play poker, but he's still very excited. You see, Sven is a dealer for Porsche, and he's just found out that PokerStars players earn $7.5 million in VIP points every month. And with our all-inclusive program, that's enough to redeem 5 of the lovely pieces of German engineering every day.
Yeah!
Keep Sven happy. Visit PokerStars.com/VIP to find out why our rewards program seems to leave other schemes, well, out of commission. PokerStars VIP Club, the best online poker reward program.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast presented by PokerStars. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's April 15th, 2011, and you're listening to the best PokerCast on the internet. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
How goes it, buddy?
It goes well, but you know... some of these things, life can be frustrating at times, can't it?
Every day that I work with you.
Yeah, well, that's a given. Fortunately, at night, you don't have to hear from me too much, you know, after my 6 o'clock call during your dinner.
Yeah.
And then we could settle into our big couches and watch TV, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
And what I find frustrating is we live in an era now with about 400 channels on my DirecTV. That I pay way too much for every month. 6,000 shows on demand on DirecTV. Cases and cases of DVDs. And I still get bored watching TV. I still go find myself going, God, there's nothing on. How does that happen?
I say the same thing all the time, dude. I don't know either. It's bizarre.
Absolutely brutal. So, I mean, what we do then is we, my wife and I, we force ourselves to tape some shows that... You know, we think we might like, and then, you know, you do the little season pass thing, and even if you don't like it, it keeps accumulating.
Yeah.
You know, on the TiVo, and then, so when you get to these desperation times, you're like, oh, boy, should we give this show another shot? I guess we don't have anything else, and unfortunately, we have plenty of beer, so yeah, go ahead and push play, honey. And one of these shows is Retired at 35.
Oh, my God, are you serious?
Have you watched this show?
I have only watched the commercials and thought... Not a chance am I watching the same Seinfeld Boca Vista friggin' episode for a whole year. There is no way I'm watching that.
All right, well, I'll guarantee our listeners I'm getting to a poker point here eventually. but, yeah, so, you know, we saw the commercial for this. It's on TV Land, and we saw a commercial before it started, and I'm like, all right, the concept kind of got a chuckle, you know, because, you know, hey. I can kind of relate to this kid who's 35 and goes down and visits his parents in Florida and then gets tired of the 9-to-9 grind and just quits his job and lives there, right? He retires at age 35 because, you know, there's these couple people that I know that I'm really fond of that kind of got tired of the 9-to-9 grind when they were 35 and quit and... We just weren't smart enough to move in with our parents. So I thought I could relate to this guy a little bit, right? I'm like, all right, we'll watch this thing. Of course, dreadful. Absolutely.
I knew it. I'm glad you were the guinea pig for me.
Yeah, and, you know, I'm not picking on the good folks at TV Land. They do a lot of good stuff. But these original series they're doing now, the budget has to be less than the budget for the Ante Up PokerCast.
I've seen the sets on these shows, and they just look like some guy built them in his backyard. You know, from everything that their neighbors threw out on trash day.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not expecting West Wing production values here, but I'm like, wow. And, of course, the writing is bad, and the laughs are yuck-yucks, and so we watched one or two, and then we gave it up. So the other night, we were in this desperation mode, right? Tried it, you know, had our Pabst in hand, and chugging a couple of them to get prepared for it. And the very first scene, Chris, the three main characters are playing poker. So even in the desperation, depths of desperation of TV dustbin viewing, any show that can work poker into it is going to redeem itself in my mind, I think.
Yeah, It's funny how often now I hear poker references in television, and I think, I gotta say something about this on a podcast. And I'm like, you know what, if I did it every time I heard a poker reference on TV, the whole show would just, you know, be all this crap that you're talking about now, so I don't want to do it.
Anyway, the scene lasted all of 30 seconds. It was at the beginning. It was the retired kid is dead, and the dad's neighbor, and they were playing poker for pills, Chris.
Oh, jeez.
You know, they're like, hey, I raised you 3 Cialis's, and call 2 more Viagras. And, of course, you know, they get all the jargon wrong and everything.
But yeah.
Eventually, somebody goes all in and pushes all the pills in, the blues and the greens and the reds and everything, and wins. And then they're like, ooh, you're really going to – you can't pull that move down to the clubhouse. So I'm still chuckling about it now. It's not Tosh.0 kind of funny. But I still keep chuckling that people can invent new ways to add poker to bad shows.
Oh my god! You know that's there's a show out called Body of Proof now, and they did a show last week about they're in Philadelphia, and they talked about this casino, and the casino that they were parroting was I guess there's like a Rocky Gap casino or something.
Yes.
You know, and they said, well, I play a mean game of Hold'em, and I thought. Yeah, there's no Hold'em in the casino that they're parodying, you know. And I started thinking about how literal I am about poker, and you know, on TV they didn't even do the research to if they're gonna parody a freaking casino in their area, they should use like parks or, you know, or something that they know there's poker, but they didn't. So anyway, yeah, it's funny. You're rediscovering stuff that's on television because you have nothing else to watch, and so I started doing that too. But I did it with an actual poker show, Poker After Dark. Last week I brought up Poker After Dark and a little bit, and again this week more stuff to talk about. One of the things that's really bothering, this actually carries over from last week too, is I'm listening to Ali Najad, and he keeps coming up with these like newer type nicknames for hands now, for starting hands. Like he's really trying to drive home, like whenever there's a king and a queen, he's calling it the throne.
Awesome. You know, well, you know, the new HBO show Game of Thrones is out, so it's probably in his consciousness.
That could be it. You know, for me, when I hear the throne, I think of a toilet. So
yeah, I was gonna say.
I don't know, and I realize what he's doing there. Obviously, you know, the royalty, the marriage. You know. But I always think of a marriage, you know, because of, I guess, I don't know if it's a pinochle or whatever. But you know, he keeps doing it now, and like now he like when there's 2, you know, paint cards in their hand, instead of saying paint, he says artwork. He says, oh, Joey's got his artwork. Oh, what is that, Ollie? I don't understand. So really, I'm starting to think, and maybe we should just stop doing this altogether. Stop calling hands by nicknames. I find myself doing it every time you and I are doing TV audio for our TV shows. And, you know, I mean, I guess it could be entertaining if the people don't know it. But I'm not going to start inventing my own names. But at the same time, I don't want to keep saying the same thing every time Ace King comes up, call it Big Slick. And then it's like I'm going to start turning to Jeff Probst. You know, I'm saying the exact same thing every single, you know, why even just to play the same recording from the week before then? And not, you know what I mean? It sounds so silly to me to try to invent your own nicknames for hands on a TV show. Like you're trying to make your own lexicon existence or something. I don't know. It just seems weird to me. Doesn't that sound weird?
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And, you know, I've been noticing it too. You know, I don't watch a lot of poker on TV, but, you know, since we are good friends with Kirk and Chicago Jason and all the Windy City crew, and they're helping us out with our stuff, I've been watching the Windy City stuff lately, and I got to pick out my good friend Chicago Jason here, because the episode I watched last night, Barack Obama came up like 3 times.
Yeah, the 2 fours.
Pocket fours. All right, I'm like, that's amazingly clever. I'll give you points. And actually, I think he said Kirk coined that. He just keeps repeating it. But then I started thinking, how many times do people get pocket fours in one episode?
Really?
I heard it 3 times. But I did the same thing you did. I'm like, whoa, are we doing the same thing? Because yeah. If I'm making fun of him and you're making fun of Ali, people must be making fun of us if we're doing it. So we got to find a way not to do it.
Yeah, I got to stop saying stuff like that. And if I do, you got to slap me or something. So
that's what we need to do. We'll put a little taser gun on each of us.
And the other thing, though, this
he's
week...
He's got walking sticks!
It's like that episode of Cheers when Cliff comes in and they got the guy with the buzzer. Yeah. You ever see that episode?
Yes, of course.
He's like, every time I say something stupid or arrogant, you gotta buzz me. And then then like a hot chick walks by and it goes off and he's like, what are you doing? He's like, oh, sorry, reflex. You know? didn't mean to do that. At the end, he steals it back from him. He says, take that! And he hits it, and he does it to himself. He doesn't realize that it's not. That was a pretty good episode. I could just see me and you in the booth now going back and forth grabbing the taser.
We have to have our own, though.
So. but this week is really cool. They are doing Pot Limit Omaha Cash Game. And AZ Slick emailed us about that, too. He's like, hey, guys, check out Poker After Dark this week. And so I did. And I want to thank him for that because it's just sick. The pots are just absolutely sick. And they are larger than any No Limit Hold'em pots that you see on TV, almost. I mean, it's just and the average size pot definitely is. It's incredible how sick these pots get. And then some of these guys, you know, they're calling down with kings, you know, thinking that they're good. And
yeah.
One of the things they're doing is they've added Andy Block to the studio with Ali, which is, to me, very refreshing. Not that I think Andy Block is a great personality or anything of that nature, but just to have someone else in there talking to him to give Ali someone to bounce stuff off of and back and forth, it's so refreshing. And, you know, they asked Andy because he's a good Omaha player, obviously, and he went deep in that horse thing and lost a chip that time. It's really good to have. And they're using the four-color deck, Scott.
Awesome.
But only for the graphics. So when you're watching it on the board and then you look at the graphics, it's kind of jarring because you're kind of like, hey, all right, the blue diamonds and the green clovers. And then all of a sudden it's like, whoa, where is the diamonds on the board? And you're like, oh, wait, they're red. You know, it's kind of jarring at first. But it's awesome that they've got this, you know, that they're breaking out of their shell. And I'm actually getting Jean kind of interested in this game now just because she's seen it on TV and seen all the possibilities. And when she heard that it's like you get six Hold'em hands for your four Omaha cards, kind of perked her ears up a little bit. So,
yeah.
But the one thing I got to say, Scott, is last night they talked about this prop bet. And, you know, we're talking about our prop bets and stuff. And
yeah, I was going to say, were they talking about the Dongtathlon? That would be awesome.
I think that when you hear this prop bet, I think all of our prop bets will never even come close to this. And we'll probably laugh at ever doing one ever again. But Tom Dwan turns to Phil Ivey. And by the way, the cast for this, you know, the guys at the table is huge. I mean, you know, Brian Hastings, not a lot of people may know him, but he's the one who beat up on Isildur 1 that time for like $3 million or whatever it was. And then Phil Galfond and Brandon Adams and Patrick Antonius. So it's all the big PLO guys and lots of money. So anyway, Dwan turns to Ivy and he's like, hey, I've got a legitimate prop bet for you. And Ivy's like, oh, I always like legitimate prop bets. So what do you got? So he says, I'll pay you $40,000 right now so that I can request action at any time between now and the end of the year, or within a year, calendar year, in a 50,000, 100,000 blind horse game against you, heads up. So the blinds would be 50,000, 100,000, okay? Now, you got to remember, Dwan sucks at horse games, okay? He may be okay, and he may figure out the Omaha and the limit hold him, but when it comes to the stud games, he's clueless. So he says, you accept this bet, and if you decline at me at any time that I ask for this action, you have to pay me $1 million. That's the buyout, $1 million. So I'm paying you 40 grand for the right to ask you to play 50K, 100K horse against me, heads up, anytime in the next calendar year. And if you reject me or you say, no, I don't want to do it, you have to buy out for $1 million. And there's no like, oh, let me buy out for 150. No, the buyout is $1 million. So then they say they have to play for 100,000 hands when they do play. Okay.
100,000 hands?
100,000 hands of horse. All right. Then they said, if after all these hands are played, Ivy is up, he'll give Dwan back 96% of his winnings. That means he's literally paying 25-1 because he's paying $1 million versus 40 grand or whatever it is. So it's giving him 25-1 odds on his money by giving him back 4%. And he thinks he's that much better than Dwan, or that no matter how much Dwan studies over the next year or plays, that, you know, that discipline, yeah, he'll still have that much of an edge. I think that's just absolutely sick. Imagine, if you will, if Dwan was up 1,000 big bets. That's $100 million. Think about that for a minute.
Yeah.
So literally, Ivy is putting up his entire net worth to play this kid heads up. And really, all this, it's like this kid's playing 2,000, 4,000 versus whenever he makes a bet, to him in his mind, it's really only like playing 2,000, 4,000 instead of 50 and a million. 50 and 100,000, I mean. So it's just crazy. So really, I mean, with him just dumping 40 grand over to Ivy for the hell of it to have this thing, you know, he'd give me 40 grand. After all, I mean, I cashed in a horse event, and I'll teach him for 40 grand how to play the stud games. You know, I think I could easily break even against Ivy if I played 100,000 hands with him, you know. Of course, I'm joking, but it's not a sick bet. That is a sick bet, and then Ivy gives him back 96% of his winnings.
Well, what's even more interesting about these bets, and particularly this one, is the brain power exerted
to come up with
to
it,
create it, and all the little intricacies in it.
I know.
It's not like, you know, hey, $25, I could beat you at a horse in the basketball court today. Oh, yeah, all right. No, that's too boring for them. At least four of your shots have to bank off of the ground and in. No. How about this? And I'm like, I wish I had this much time. I really did.
If 96% of your shots don't hit the rim, I'll give you 10% back on your money. It's hilarious. How do they even come up with this stuff? But that's just sick. That's how much Ivy thinks that no matter how much Dwan studies, he'll kick his butt and give him a refund, you know? So even if he loses $1 million to Ivy, all he's losing is his $40,000 initial investment.
Wow.
Isn't that crazy?
Whew. You know, I would offer a rebate on my wins to any of the NDAP Nation, but I don't have any. So
that might change this weekend, my friend.
We'll see. Speaking of Hot Limit Omaha, event number 3 for Apes is this Saturday at noon Eastern. Great time for all of our European Omaha players. Don't disappoint me, guys, because, you know, I get beat up when I put these events at noon on a Saturday.
Yeah.
People go, I can't go. And I'm like, I'm doing it for my European guys. So represent. All the details are at anyupmagazine.com/apes. Game is, of course, Pot Limit Omaha, $5.50 buy-in for everybody who didn't qualify in the satellite on April 6th. That would be everybody but me and four other people.
And don't forget that Rant is doing his little giveaway thing. This time it's asking for what your favorite poker game is and why, and you have to post it by the 20th. Now, that's for the No Limit Hold'em thing, though, right? That's not for the
That's correct. That's for event number 4. And you'll find that thread in the Antiup Magazine forum at antiupmagazine.com/forum. And, you know, Chris, my hunt for bananas remains elusive in two tracks.
Yeah.
One, obviously online. Yeah. People can watch how futile I've been trying to win a banana there. But this week, I went to a baseball game, and I'm like, you know, hey, on the way home, honey, we got to stop at Walmart because, you know, people are starting to win new bananas, and I got to get them in the mail, and we're fresh out of bananas on the swag show.
Oh, we ran out?
Yeah, and she was like, wow, that sounds like a wonderful date, honey. I can't wait.
I had no idea we ran out.
Yeah, so, you know, after the game, I drag her into Walmart, and, you know, we head back to the arts and crafts section where the plastic bananas are stored, in theory. And I get back to the back wall there, and there are apples, Chris. There are oranges. There are pears.
Are there grapes?
There were grapes, I imagine, maybe some apricots. There were probably even ugly fruits. You know those ugly fruit things?
Yeah, absolutely.
But no bananas. I looked on all four shelves, and I'm like, I turned to my wife, and I'm like, where the hell are the bananas? And, of course, you know, this is great at this point, because I dragged her all the way into Walmart, all the way to the back of the store.
Yeah.
And there are no bananas.
I can't believe she doesn't just, like, stay in the car and listen to music or something. Why would she go in?
But you know how far back the back of the store, the Walmart, is?
I know. That's what I'm saying. Why go through all that with you? Just stay in the car.
Well, she was probably in my car with the top down and stuff.
Okay.
Melted and stuff. So, but, you know, I had a look. I'm like, I want to get on the internet, and I'll probably do this after the show, and I'm going to Google bananacrafts.com. Because there must be just a very dedicated group of people who use only bananas in their plastic fruit crafts. They weren't out of anything else, but they are always out of bananas.
That is weird.
Are there people that I walk in their house and like, oh yeah, that's there's like an entire banana room? Stuff this, like, you know, flowers and pillows and stuff coming out of them? Yeah, I made those last week. Yeah.
If this were a different show, I would take this to an entirely different level. But I'm not going to do that.
I just want to know where the bananas are. I mean, I wonder, is it seriously, are there listeners that are like, hey, I can't win a banana, so I'm just going to hop on a plane, get off at Tampa International Airport, drive to the Walmarts in both Oldsmar and Palm Harbor, and buy up all the bananas so Scott can't get them either. I can't explain it.
Maybe the banana manufacturers are boycotting Walmart because of their prices and treatment of employees or something.
Maybe Chiquita's getting involved and saying, hey, you know, you're causing confusion with our real product, so, you know, can you not put them on the shelves? So, so I apologize to Drunko666. It took me a while to get your banana. The only reason your banana's in the mail, sir, is because three bananas went unclaimed last year. So I had to actually open up those boxes because I already pre-wrapped the boxes and everything, you know,
because
mode and I get them all done once. I had to open the box and then peel off the label from last year's.
Thank God it's not engraved.
Yeah. And then I had to save it just in case that person ever claimed it. And then put your label on it, Drunko, and put it back in the box and take it to the post office. So hopefully you'll get it soon, and hopefully a massive delay in delivery of bananas here soon.
So, you know, actually, you actually do have bananas in the house then, you know?
I have two left.
You could literally take those two and put them on your mantle as if you won those two events and live vicariously through the plastic.
I could have, but now, obviously, you know, if the Walmart stalker dude doesn't click the right button and get some more in, then I'm going to have to recycle. I'm going to have to re-gift them.
Oh, my God, that's hilarious. Well, good luck on Saturday, buddy.
All right, thank you, buddy.
Hey, I need you to read the mailbag, because I answered this guy's question, and I kind of liked my answer, so I want to give it.
Just because you read the questions, I mean, you can't go, yeah.
Well, I know, but I don't know if they want to hear my voice for the next 20 minutes, you know.
You want to be the first one to answer is what you're saying, because your answer is so much better than my answer.
No, it's probably the same answer, but I just, I went through the trouble of actually getting the answer and printing it out, and so I want to read it.
Okay, so you're invested in this mailbag.
Yeah, I've got time invested. I don't want to waste it.
All right, here we go. It comes from Michael Wimmer in Mesa, Arizona. I love that area out there.
I've never been
there.
It's a dry
heat.
Yeah, never been there.
Very nice. You should go.
Okay.
He says he plays in a monthly home game, which usually consists of seven players. He says he loves the stud games, Raz, Stud High, and Stud High Low. And he's the only player who calls these games, though, Chris.
Not surprising.
He says, I study and practice stud and feel that I have a slight advantage of these games. However, whenever I call stud, I only call for one hand of the game, as most of the players don't like these games. However, I usually end up folding right away because a lot of times I receive a substandard starting hand and I'm not throwing my money away just because I called the game. However. He's used a lot of however.
A lot of however's. He's used his quota for the day.
Yeah. I'm not going to be able to use however for the rest of the show. This generally prevents me from playing my stronger games. Is it acceptable to call for a round of stud when it's my turn to call the game? One player mentioned I shouldn't, as a round of any stud game will take too long. However, it takes at least 15 to 20 minutes, sometimes a lot longer to play games such as push, 3-5-7, etc., which are frequently called during our sessions. I'm considering forcing the issue, but I wanted your opinion on the matter. What do you guys do during your home games when stud is called? Is it for a single hand or for a round?
Okay, well...
I'll take this one, Chris.
Yeah, the last part. I didn't answer the last part for him, though. Yeah, the last part is that we use a timer. So you call, you get 15 minutes to play your games. you know, whatever. And then
I will interject just to say it's kind of ridiculous to call a game for one hand.
If
anybody's doing that in their home game, that's kind of weird. At least do it for a round.
And that's the other thing too, is if we're really shorthanded, then we do, I think, or if we're really shorthanded, we do a round, a couple of rounds or something, so we know that enough hands will get in, or I don't know, whatever it is. But we definitely don't do one hand at a time. But here's what I said to him. I said, you abide by what they call and when it's their turn to choose a game, so I feel guilty about calling a game you prefer to play for a round, especially games like Push. I don't even know what the hell that is, by the way.
Yeah.
So I said, if this is a cash game, which obviously it is, then time shouldn't be an issue. And if your boys are calling bastardized games like these ones, then and they already know how to play them, then how can they be whining about calling a true poker game like Stud? You know, it's a home game, and you get to call whatever you want, and they're welcome to call what they want. You know, Doyle Brunson put it best in Super System, and I'm glad we're bringing that up because that's part of our show this week. Sometimes you have to give action to get action. If they want to have the freedom to call what they want to play, how can they not give you the same freedom? You still live in America, right? That was what I wrote to him, and he loved that answer. He said he's going to print it out and read it at the home game. So I'm hoping he doesn't get beat up or anything.
AC is pretty close to Mexico, so you know, I don't know where his home game is.
That's true. That's what I wrote. I mean, I think that it's bull that you get looked at funny because you're calling stud games and they're calling 3-5-7.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little different in our home game. Every once in a while, I like to push the envelope a little bit and think about, you know, really doing something like maybe like Crazy Pineapple High Low or something.
Yeah.
And I know people are going to go, are you serious? And then suggest another game and shame me into changing it. So I feel a little bad about that because in our games, we play mostly real poker games, or at least very close variations to it. You know, we haven't done Juarez in a while.
Right, right.
But if I'm in a game where these, you know, Follow the Queen, Knight Baseball, all these other kind of weird things are being played, I don't know how anybody can get upset that you're playing a real game.
I know. That's so crazy. The farthest that our game strays from bracelet games, essentially, is like Double Flop Hold'em. And even then, you're still playing Hold'em. It's just two boards.
Yeah.
So, I mean, really, I mean, if they're playing all these wacky, you know, backroom, kitchen table, hey, let's try to make as many royal flushes with all the wild cards we can think of hand games, then, I mean, just calling stud, I wouldn't feel guilty at all. And I would make them feel guilty for making you feel guilty.
That's the Chris Cosenza power core. Make them feel guilty. But, you know, here's the last thing I'll say, too, is this issue, like a lot of issues, you can be right and wrong at the same time. So while we're saying, yeah, it's America, blue, you know, call what you want, it's free. If eventually they say, you know what, take your stud and go play the retired at 35 pill game down the street, and you get kicked out of the game, then is it worth it? So that's something you got to consider. I mean, are you taking away the overall fun of the game by being so principled? And if that's the case, then maybe you have a different answer. But if you're not worried about that, then yeah.
Yeah.
Call away.
Yeah. Yeah, no. I mean, especially if they're rubes. You don't want to leave a game that you're going to be making a lot of money on just because you feel like playing stud. If you can still win a lot of money playing these other games and they're going to keep hassling you and whatever, and there's a chance that you can get thrown out of the game or whatever, don't do it. But really, if it sounds like it's your buddies, and if it's your buddies, they should understand, then stop busting your balls.
You know, the other thing I might do, though, is if they really like playing these weird games, I'm going to create my own weird games. I'm going to be like, all right, Scott, it's on you. I'm going to like, all right, we're going to play Pull.
Pull.
And they're going to like, what's Pull? And I'm like, well, it's like Push, except for, and I'm going to sit there and study how to tweak one or two rules and really just slap them around. That's what I'm going
to
do.
Kind of like when Chandler played Cups with Joey. He wanted to give him money. And you ever see that episode?
Yeah,
come on,
yeah.
Man. I got all these TV references. Oh, when you got that, you have to double it. Just make up rules and give yourself a bunch of money. All right, so what's he win?
All right, Mike. Well, you know, here's the other thing, too. If you hit some resistance from these other six players, we're going to help you out here. We're going to send you a deck of J-Design playing cards, the official playing cards of Anti-Up. Now available in the Anti-Up store at antiupstore.com. And when they say, whoa, 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 we're not going to let you call stud when you want. You're going to go, what if we play with these great cards? They're going to go, stud all night!
or at least make sure that your deck is the only deck in the house. And so if they try to throw you out of the game, you say, oh, yeah, well, I'm taking my cards with me.
Yeah, I'm taking my cards and going home. I can play stud by myself.
All right, well, our hotline is up next, 813-448-1120. We're hoping you call, and if you do, we use it. We'll give you something really cool. This one's interesting because, you know, we had a couple of calls and even a little bit of a back and forth on the forum, antiupmagazine.com/forum, about last week's comment that I made about the dealer being the same as the muck, or an extension of the muck.
Extension of the muck. Come on, extension of the muck. Get the phrasing right. It's classic now.
So what I'll do is I'll let the clip play, and then we'll talk a little bit about it and what we talked about last week.
It's Don from St. Louis. On the recent show, the mailbag about the heads-up hand where someone asks to see the hand, I think your comments were incorrect. If the dealer touches the cards, they could still be retrieved and they could still be live. The distinction is who asks to see the hand. If a outside party asks to see it, the dealer, I believe, is instructed to touch the cards to the muck to indicate that they're dead and show the hand just to check for collusion. If the person in the hand, the other person that actually won the pot, insists on seeing the other person's cards, even if they're in the muck and retrievable, they would be alive again. The hand is reactivated if the interested party is in the hand. It's, I guess, a penalty or a consequence for insisting on seeing the hand.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those things where a couple of the emails we got, I responded to folks, and I'm like, I felt bad that I didn't mention this because I had meant to, but I got confused. Remember, I got confused in the hand, and I thought the hand was face up, not face down.
Yeah.
And so when I realized that, I had to backtrack and explain all that, and I totally forgot that most, almost every dealer I've seen will pick the hand up and touch it to the muck.
Yeah.
That way it's, quote-unquote, mocked. Though we've gotten other feedback on that that said that, you know, it may not be that important, or other people don't. You know, so it's really turned out to be a fairly interesting issue to debate.
Well, the thing that what I meant by saying the extension of the muck was that it is the dealer's responsibility when someone indicates they're folding and they have folded, and as soon as he touches those cards, he's supposed to touch them to the muck. So essentially, his job is, as soon as he touches them, to touch to the muck, so that means he is the muck, essentially, is what I mean by that.
All right, that makes sense.
You know what I'm saying? So I'm not saying that, and then I even clarified on the forum, obviously, if a dealer touches your cards, they're not muck, because a lot of them will come up to your cards and say, did you fold? And he'll touch your cards, you know, I mean, obviously, they're not muck. I just mean that his job is, when you're folding, and indicate, and in this hand, this guy folded, and that we talked about, he made the motion, and that was the other thing, too, I quoted Kelly Mix's book on the poker rules, that if anyone makes any kind of forward motion with their cards, they're considered dead if they're in a folding motion. So once he touches them, you know, his job is to touch the muck, so he is essentially the muck once he touches them, because he's going to the muck with them immediately. He's not supposed to give them back to anybody. And they've folded, so he's enforcing the rule of the fold. So that's what I meant. The other thing, too, is I put on there, too, I would really like somebody this weekend or whenever, when they're playing, to literally fold their cards. And as a dealer touches them, say, wait, 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 I want my hand back, because he didn't touch into the muck yet. I want to see if you can actually get your hands back from somebody. I have never seen anyone get their cards back from a dealer in their hands without, like, there being like, oh, I didn't mean to fold, or if the dealer took them when you were looking at the dogs racing by or something, and then they got because they're retrievable, and you know what I mean? Obviously, cards that were thrown into the muck accidentally by a dealer can be retrievable if they can identify him and all that. We talked about that, but that wasn't the case here. The case here was the guy folded. He literally folded. You knew he folded. The dealer touched his cards. Once the dealer touches his cards, they should be considered dead because he's enforcing the rule of the fold that the guy intended, and he's touching the muck with him. He's supposed to touch the muck with him. So anyway, it's a long way around it, but yeah, you can retrieve the cards if there's a dispute. And you get the floor person over, and those cards are identifiable and retrievable, even if you have to go to the eye in the sky, you know. But when this isn't a dispute, you can't get the because you're curious about the cards, you can't turn them over. I mean, you know what I mean? It's just people were taking it too literal when I said that, so I'm glad we got that out. But
so let me get this straight, Chris. What you are asking our nation to do this week is go out. Purposely do something that a lot of people think is probably wrong. Probably get beat up, penalized, mocked incessantly. so they can call the hotline and send an email and let you know how it went out.
Well, no.
Did I hear that correctly?
You totally took it the wrong way. No. I don't mean for them to try to play the hand after they get it shown. What I'm saying is, if I want to see someone who gets deuce seven, or whatever, I always say deuce of seven, but deuce seven in their hand, not want it, fold it forward past the betting line. As the dealer touches them, say, oh, wait a minute, I want my cards back, just to see what the dealer says. Because you're not doing anything wrong there. You're not trying to play your hand. This is like even pre-flop is what I'm saying. It doesn't make a difference. I want to see the dealer say, oh, sorry. Oh, you really want your cards back? Here you go. No, he'll say you folded your hand, and I have to grab your cards. And he won't give – once he touches those cards, he's not giving them back to you. He's not. And if he does, I want to hear about it. So we're not. That's not creating any problem. No one's going to get beat up because they folded deuce seven by hand and said, oh, I want it back. No way. They're not going to play the hand.
Yeah, okay, here, this is going to be my advice then to listeners. Please go ahead and dry this at your risk. When you are on the ground being pummeled by the other players at the table, I want you to be sure that, but Chris Cosenza from Antium asked me to.
Even when the dealer starts to give them back to you, you say, no, I'm just kidding, you know, because then it's funny, and then you won't get in trouble.
It is funny.
But they're not going to give you your cards back. It's just not going to happen. So they're not retrieval from the dealer. I don't care what you say. The dealer's not going to give you your cards back. And he's certainly not going to show your hand to everybody before he touches that mug. And they're not going to be live when he shows the hand. It's just not going to happen. It's mucked. You mucked it. I'm sorry.
Oh, boy. All this muckety-muck is going to be exciting to give away some swag here. So, Dan, we appreciate the call. We will send you a T-shirt from PMS Pokerware, which sells hilarious shirts for gals and guys in the Antium store at antiumstore.com. It's been a while since I've created a shirt, Chris. So I am going to ask Robin to create a, hi, I'm the dealer. I'm the extension of the muck shirt, and try to see how many people we get to buy that. And I'm sure Shy Guy up in Chicago will probably be the first one to buy that.
Hey, everything we say is fodder for him and his boys. All right, well, our feedback this week comes from Nikki C. He's one of our...
Very creative way of getting around not having to pronounce his last name.
Ciavarella. I could say his name.
Okay, all right.
But, you know, I didn't know if he wanted his name said. Now you've made me say it, so.
All right. Nikki C's pretty cool,
Nikki
too.
Nikki C, yeah. Cause something tells me they call him that up there. He's from New York. So he writes in often to us, occasionally getting his letters published in our magazine, too, for some stuff that he comments on. And he's always provided us with good stuff. So this is. Gets back to last week. We're talking about folding when it's out of your turn, you know, because you know you're going to fold anyway. Remember that whole conversation we had when it's not your turn to act?
And of course.
So he says, folding on your turn to act when not facing a bet is highly unethical in any form of poker. It offers no protection for remaining players and is the action of a complete novice player. I have found the reason easier to explain using 7-card stud as an example. Consider sitting in a multiplayer hand with a player first to act representing a very powerful board, like an open-ended straight flush draw. He says, you have a full house and you know that you can only be beat by the player in front of you. Instead of checking, he folds. The other player is now subjected to you betting and costing him money that you could never have wagered if the player checked for fear that he might check raise. I would suspect a form of collusion and not allow any further betting. What do you think about that?
Well, I wrote back, Nick, and we've actually had a good back-and-forth conversation about this. I don't disagree that there are ethical concerns that people may not have considered in this. I certainly agree that it's almost always the action of a, quote, complete novice player. But what I had to ask him was, the last line is what threw me off, is, all right, I get the suspecting collusion. All right, that's fair. But not allow any further betting? To me, that seems punitive to the other players in the hand if it is, in fact, a novice player, which more often than not it is.
Right.
I mean, I would think as a player, if someone checked or tried to fold out of turn, and then the dealer said, all right, that's it, hands over,
yeah.
And called the floor over, I'd be like, whoa, wait a minute. I didn't do anything wrong.
Yep.
So we haven't really reconciled that on his side, but you know, again, my overall point was, you know, this is one of those things that's frustrating, but you can't unring a bell, you know, when someone says, I'm folding, It doesn't matter whether you take his cards now or later. He's folding. And everybody knows it. So all you could do at that point is turn it into a teaching example. Remind the player you can't do it. You know, if you feel like it, you could give him a warning or a penalty or something to you know, puff your chest out and feel good about yourself. But I don't see anything else you can do at that point.
No. And if anybody finds out how to unring a bell, please email podcast@annieupmagazine.com. I would love to see that happen.
That would be definitely worthy of some swag. And of course, there's a new riddle thread going on in the forum, too. I don't know if you saw that.
No, I haven't seen that.
Yeah, you should check it out in the off-topic thing. Some really good ones in there. You should probably get your friend Vanessa Russo to join in next. She loves the riddles. But that might be one we can post there. Of course, you know, we don't have the answer for it. But guessing for a while, right?
Vegas, baby!
Woo!
We're going to Vegas, baby! We always go to Vegas.
I'm excited because I haven't been there in a long time. I took last year off.
Yeah, it's so weird because you go there like 10 times more than the average human being. So for you to not go for a year, it was kind of like Vegas shut down.
Yeah,
it would be a
completely different way to get there. It could be like, you know, San Jose or something.
San Jose. What happens in San Jose stays in San Jose.
I can see that. Yeah, absolutely.
But we've got some tentative dates. We think we're going to be out there. June 28th, we're going to land, we think, and then come home the 2nd of July. So we're and pretty excited. We're going to go out there and maybe even try to have a meetup, right?
Yeah. Well, everything is tentative right now, but I think the dates are pretty accurate. And you know, we'll try to find a good place to host a little meetup. You know, we've done two of them out there.
Yeah.
First one at Binion's was legendary. Second one at Caesar's, not so legendary. But, you know, folks might not know this, but we're expanding the magazine to Nevada with this upcoming issue.
Yes.
So if you live in the Las Vegas or Reno or Laughlin or any of those great areas, you'll be able to pick up Ante Up now every month. So, you know, part of it going out there is it would be an opportunity for us to do meet up for the listeners, but maybe something a little bit more for the magazine. So looking forward to it.
Very excited. Very exciting about seeing our magazine in the legendary poker rooms of this country. I mean, I just to think that our magazine is going to be in Binion's, you know, things like that. It's so exciting.
Very good. So as we get more details, we'll be sure to announce them on the show. But if you're looking to figure out when to go now and you want to, hey, I want to be out there and, you know, check Ray Scott, you might want to plan to be there June 28th through July 2nd.
I looked at the World Series schedule for those days, too, and there's, like, the triple chances going on. I think we can, you and I could afford $3,000 each, don't you think?
I'm looking at the Binion's Cup, man. There is a Limit Omaha 8 when we're out there.
Oh,
that's
awesome.
All me.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. And then also the Nugget event's going across the street.
Right across
there,
the
too.
Street, yep. Absolutely. Yeah. So, you know, our Chad Brown show, do I have to say the title again?
Yes. You're contractually obligated to mangle the title every time we have to say
the
it.
The Chad Brown No Limit Texas Hold'em Championship is going to air on several networks around the country, including Comcast Sportsnet Chicago, Cox Cable in the South, Bright Owl Sports Network around here in Florida, and likely also in California and the Mid-Atlantic. Pretty crazy, man. We're everywhere, baby.
It's spreading.
Like a virus.
It's like Phil Ivey.
Visit AnnieUpMagazine.com for an updated schedule.
Yeah, we'll get the schedule up there. It does, because we use regional sports networks, it does change a little bit. You know, the mighty Blackhawks in Chicago made the playoffs. I don't know if you noticed that.
Yeah.
Totally messed up the whole airing schedule. But always check AnnieUpMagazine.com for the most up-to-date schedule and all the networks where it's going to be on. And for those who have DirecTV, this is good news because a couple of these other channels, including Comcast Sportsnet Chicago, are on DirecTV, unlike CSS. So
very good.
You'll be able to find it eventually.
And as Scott mentioned earlier in the show, we have what's known as the Annie Up Store. AnnieUpStore.com has Annie Up logo items and dozens of other awesome poker products. And just 2 weeks left, Scott, to order your, quote, retro baseball cap with the Annie Up logo on it.
Retro hat or trucker hat, whichever makes you buy it. I will let you call it whatever you want. First purchase came from Las Vegas, Chris. So see, the word is already out.
Awesome. Very good.
That we're going to be out there. People are already getting ready. They want to be geared up for when we show up.
Yeehaw! All right, let's go on to our Annie Up news desk.
All right, we've got a special Where is Poker Expanding episode of the Annie Up news desk, Chris. I feel like an SNL bit here. How do you get there from here? Need Phil Hartman or something to host this. All right, we're going to rapid fire go through. There's a lot of stuff going on with a lot of states on poker, so we're just going to do a little rapid fire here. Right?
Excellent, yep.
All right, Washington, D.C.? Yes! The federal government didn't step in to object to a new budget that allows the district's lottery provider to allow poker and other casino games. No timetable yet on when to expect it.
Hawaii? No! As quickly as it was proposed, lawmakers have scuttled an idea to allow online and live poker in the nation's 50th state.
Maine? Maybe! A new bill, if approved, would allow Hollywood Slots and Banger to add table games.
Florida? No soup for you! A bill to create an interstate poker network in the Sunshine State died in committee.
Nevada? Maybe. A Nevada state assemblyman is pushing ahead with his bill to create an interstate network in that state, despite concerns from the governor about what would happen if the federal government acts on online poker. And that's this week's...
That was fun.
Where is poker expanding?
Well, that was so exciting. Usually we have some sort of comment about it and stuff, but really, what are you going to say? It pretty much says it all right there. Two maybes, two no's, and a yes. Which, even the yes to me, I mean, it's one city. I mean, how are they going to sustain a poker room in one city anyway?
It's a city, and it's being run by a lottery. So, I mean, I hope it works out, but this is not the not necessarily the legislation I think we were all hoping would be the first one passed. But good luck to the folks. If you live in D.C., that's great news for you.
Absolutely.
Remember, Sven, our friendly Poker Stars Porsche dealer? Sven's still very excited.
Yeah!
He already knows that Poker Stars players together earn enough VIP points to redeem 5 Porsches every day. What's made him a little more excited is the fact that 5 of our Poker Stars players have already claimed these lovely pieces of German engineering. Keep Sven happy. Visit PokerStars.com/VIP to find out why our rewards program seems to have left all the other schemes, well, stuck in neutral. PokerStars VIP Club, the best online poker reward program.
All right, Scott, Chris, oh, look, I called you me.
You called you me? Wow, that's crazy.
That's terrible.
That is absolutely crazy.
All right, can we just take a pause here? I need to go shower.
You called me Scott. I have to shower. I
insulted myself. There's nothing more insulting than me confusing me for you.
Hey, thanks, buddy. I appreciate it.
All right, Chris, this was your idea, and it's a great idea. So I'm going to let you babble on about what it is and set it up because I think it's fantastic.
Sure. Well, you know, one day you were playing poker at Derby Lane. And
the start of our children's book.
You were at the, it might have been a final table, but you were at, I think you were at a final table.
It was on Thanksgiving, actually.
Yeah, on Thanksgiving.
Because I'm a family guy, you know, when on major holidays, you'll find me at the poker tables.
Oh, but there's this lady who's sitting with you at the table, and she strikes up a conversation with you. I think she sees your Annie Up shirt, and she starts saying, you know, I'm a book publisher, and, you know, I do this... we have this new imprint now called No Limit Publishing, and we're actually working on a poker book. Do you know anyone who might want to edit the book? And so you're like, well, not me, but my partner might want to. So next thing you know, I'm the poker editor for this pretty fascinating poker book that's geared toward women. It's written all by the top player, female players, like in the world. You know, to me, I was very excited because all the poker books that I've ever read. You know, I've always wanted to be a part of them somehow. Some of them are just poorly edited, but mostly just because, you know, I think it's kind of cool to be, you know, part of, you know, it's out there. You know, it's like if you're in a movie or something, I mean, you'll always be in that movie for the rest of time, you know. So I always wanted to be a part of it. So as soon as I got that email from you, I was like, yes, tell her I want to do it. So then when I saw the names attached to it, you know, Linda Johnson, Jan Fisher, Clooney Gowan, you know, Karina Jett, Christy Gazes, Maria Ho. I mean, just, you know, some of the biggest names, Susie Isaacs, J.J. Liu, Liz Liu, just some huge names in the poker world. And I was like, yeah, I definitely want to do this. So as I'm editing each chapter and helping them rewrite their chapters and things like that, I started thinking about you know, these chapters are really good. And, you know, people are always asking us, you know, what book do you recommend? Just recently when we were on our cruise and I gave the little Advanced Hold'em strategy course, people asked about books and stuff. And I brought up Poker Tells during the instruction. So I told them about Navarro's book and Carroll's book. And so I started thinking to myself, you know, what are the best books out there? And then I thought, you know what, though? Some books, you know, they're just so big and thick and there's so many different things in there that I thought maybe I should narrow it down, because I've been dealing with chapters lately so often with this editing this book, which is going to come out this summer. And I thought, well, maybe chapters, because really when people talk to me about this, especially when I talk about other games besides Hold'em, there's one chapter in particular that changed my life as far as poker, and as a poker player. And I will get into that later, but whenever I say that, I always think that chapter did something to me. So what are the top five chapters that made me the poker player I am, or at least put me on the path to the poker player I am? So I thought that'd be an interesting thing. So then I talked to you, and you're like, yeah, it's a great idea. So I actually wrote a story in a little more detail than what we'll do today, and I'm going to put it in probably our June issue. But I thought, you know what? What are the five chapters that basically sum up me or my philosophy, you know? And you agreed, so you came up with your top five, I came up with my top five, so basically it's our top 10 poker chapters that define us.
Yeah, I'll play your reindeer games. It was actually kind of fun, too, because, you know, I got this big bookcase here of poker books, and don't always pull them off as much as I should, so forced me to get it back in there and rediscover some stuff, because, you know the top of your head, some of these. And then when you pull them off to make sure you get the titles right and stuff, then you find yourself reading them.
Yep, absolutely.
And that's great, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
But, all right, well, what I thought we should start with was discussing our philosophy on this, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I love when you see these top 10 lists or something like that, then you always have some jackwagon that goes, how could you not put Titanic on the list? It was the best movie ever. And then, so it's always better to say, all right, here is kind of the philosophy that we were going at with this list. It's not probably your list, but this is why we picked them. That doesn't mean, of course, that the same guy isn't going to go, how could you not put Titanic on the list? It's the best movie ever. But at least I feel a little better about myself. So here's my philosophy on my list. I just don't really enjoy the math side of poker.
Yeah.
And as such, I guarantee you, you're not going to see a Sklansky Malmuth chapter on my list. Even though I will fully admit that they are must reads for most players and probably excellent poker chapters, just don't do anything for me.
Yeah.
Same with Dan Harrington's books. I love them. They are great, but you know, he gets into all these M's and Q's and S times twos and stuff. I just don't like that stuff.
No.
So he's not going to see his stuff in there, even though other players would absolutely devour those books and love them, right?
Yep.
Also, surprise again, I'm a fan of mixed games, and really, actually, any game that's not crappy, no limit hold'em. So those kind of books are going to make it on my list a little bit more than other ones. And then also, I kind of really enjoy the poker meta issues, I call them.
Yeah.
The stuff that affects our play, but, you know, makes you a little well-rounded of player. It gets you out of comfort zone, that kind of stuff. And I think this is important, too, because, I love our listeners and our readers and stuff on the forum. But one of the things I see a lot is, I just can't get enough of hand analysis. I love talking about hands.
Yeah.
And that's great.
Yeah.
But I wonder if at times people get so fixated on the actual card playing of poker that they don't think about the things that are affecting the card playing that could be just as important to their bankroll.
Right.
This is the stuff that when you download a hand history into a spreadsheet that doesn't show up, you know, maybe you were on your fourth paps that night.
Yep.
Or maybe you're dealing with a sick pet or something like that, you know, something like that. So I kind of like looking at those type of chapters too. So that's kind of what helped me define my list.
Well, you know, like you, I'm the same about math. It's funny because I don't care about math now, especially with poker. But it's kind of shocking because when I was younger, you know, I was really good in math in high school and even in college, and I actually almost became an engineer, which is kind of funny when you think about it now.
Excellent. Amtrak or B&O?
Monopoly, actually. So, but when I, you know, when I thought of this idea, you know, I just thought, you know what, it these chapters, and for the most part too, and I'll explain this later too, but there's always a concept with the chapters that I mention here, and it's a lot easier for me to grasp a concept and then apply it rather than a whole theory that's so long and drawn out and everything. So, I don't know, to me, I just thought, you know, these chapters changed my life, and so I thought that they might change yours, and it made my poker existence enjoyable and profitable. These are the things that made me think differently than what beats what. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. So
exactly.
That was basically what I went in with. And it's not that all the other books that I read, and in an article that I wrote, or column, whatever you want to call it, I gave a lot of props to Negreanu's book, because his small ball stuff is pretty amazing, but it's like 500 pages long. And I'm like, okay, well, that's not really a chapter. It's more of an entire book or concept dedicated to small ball. And then even, you know, Ace on the River by Greenstein, it's a great read, but almost the entire book is just about how to live your life as a poker player, and then there was a little strategy in the back. So, I mean, there are just great books out there, you know, and even the Tells books. Obviously, I felt great about the Tells books, but I just felt like these were the ones that really made me think differently about poker and about how to play the game and how to play the people and stuff. So that was my philosophy. Obviously, like, I agree with you. There are tons and tons of books out there, and they're all good, and people are going to be like, how did you not put this book on there or whatever? And the funny thing is that your reasons for not putting the two people that on your list are funny, that I use those same reasons, but yet I still put them on my list. It's kind of funny, but why don't you get us started?
All right, I just hope Titanic's on your list. This is the greatest book ever. All right, here's my first book is our chapter is called Play of the Hand. It comes from Winning Low Limit Hold'em by Lee Jones. And you'll see this in a couple books too. It doesn't really have chapters. They're like little couple page discussions.
Yeah.
But it's really broken into two large sections. So in a sense, by saying Play of the Hand is one of the greatest chapters, it's really, I'm talking about the whole book, because the first chapter is really just the fundamentals. And this really is my favorite poker book of all time. So, you know, my list, my rules, right?
Yes.
So, like I said, the first section is just the fundamentals, which we all should know. But the second section delves more deeply into the actual concepts of limit hold'em. But it's written with very clear language, which is really important. You'd be amazed at how many books in general, particularly poker books, are written clunkily. Clunkily?
I don't know. Put it up there with colloquial.
Yeah,
I'm feeling collusional.
Yeah, I'm feeling a little collusional right now. No, but it's very clear language, and they have good graphics that are easy to understand. There's not a lot of you know, lost little sketches and stuff where you got to figure out things.
Right.
So really, it's great for dumb people like me, and probably very good for smart people as well too. But it's a great primer on poker, and I really do recommend it as a rereader for players, both for limit and no limit. You can actually get some good tips that can help you no limit as well.
Well, I'm so glad that you brought this up, and the reason why is we even talked about this a little bit before the show. I didn't put this on my list because I knew you would, but if you didn't, this would have been on my list probably, because I borrowed this book from you, and it really did help me play Limit Hold'em. I mean, for how long did I struggle in our game when we played Limit Hold'em in the home game?
I had no idea it was learning the book to you. Damn.
Yeah, you gave me that book, and now it's
screwed that up,
it's
not, didn't
it? You know? So, I mean, really, there were times where I would go broke before even, because we used to do this weird thing where we'd play like an hour of, you know, Limit Hold'em, and then an hour of Limit Stud.
Right, yeah.
Remember that? And I would be broke before we got to No Limit Hold'em, and I have to go home.
Yeah.
And so I was determined to learn how to play this game, borrowed that book from you, and that really made me a much better limit player, and allows me to play games like horse now properly. But since you put that on your list, I knew there was one on my list that you would have put on your list had I not done. So we actually kind of got away with having a top six, kind of. We each have each other's chapter on there. So since you used the one that I would have put on mine had not you, I'll bring up mine first. The one that literally changed my poker life and was Stud 8 by Todd Brunson on Super System 2. And I think you agree that's one of the ones that you would have put on your
absolutely.
List, right?
would have easily been on my list.
It's funny. It actually started with Faso's interview with Chip Reese way back when we were still at the Times. And he says, hey, you know, give a tip to our listeners, you know, about how to play Stud 8. And he says, always go for the low. Now, clearly that's not the only strategy you should have when you're playing this game. And it's actually a losing strategy if that's all you do. But it was a concept that I could grab and made me want to learn the game. So when I got Todd's chapter, and I kind of understood Stud 8 a little bit, when I got his chapter and he brings up the platinum rule of scooping and just the thought process behind it, and he does it in such a simple way, you know, and it there's no confusion in his book. There's no formulas and all that stuff. It's pure just, hey, this is Stud 8, this is how you should play it, and if you don't play it this way, sit in my game, please, because I want to play against you.
Yeah.
And I just really grasped everything he says there, and it's made me a much better Stud 8 player, and it's helped me with all my other games. I mean, that chapter literally helps me with all the other games, and it was really the reason why I did cash in that horse event, because I could play three Stud games well because of the things that I learned from him, and just really cleared the way for me to not just... And that's why I don't like to play Nolan Hold'em as much as I used to, because that one chapter. And it really can make that much of a difference in your career if you have never learned how to play the game.
Well, it's amazing, and I think this will come up as we continue through this list, too. It's amazing how much difference a good writing or somebody who's a good teacher can make in a chapter. You know, I had a conversation with the poker room manager yesterday. We were talking about pro players, and I'm like, you know, just because somebody is really good at poker doesn't make them a good teacher.
Right.
You know, you might learn a lot more from somebody who's not as accomplished but has a better ability to convey concepts to you. Now, obviously, I know some of these players also have really good editors that help them out, but whatever the combination that works out, if you get a chapter that is very clear and it can convey those concepts in a good manner, that's going to be a chapter worth its weight of gold, and Todd's definitely was.
And I bring this analogy up often, too. You know, when we were at the Times, people were always saying, you know, why'd that guy get promoted? You know, just because you can write a good story doesn't make him a good leader of a department.
Right, right.
You know, so when you find guys writing poker books who, yeah, they're great poker players, but they may not be a good teacher, that's not the case with Todd Brunson. I mean, and he, I think he follows his dad's footsteps a lot with his writing style, and they may even collaborate a little bit on it or whatever, but, and I'll get into him later because clearly there's going to be a chapter from Super System for me. So, but yeah, I just, you're right. I mean, he can teach so well with simple words and simple concepts, and it just definitely changed my poker career.
All right, my second one is Different Betting Limits Make for Different Style Games from Winning Omaha 8 Poker by Mark Tenner and Lou Krager.
Yeah, I never borrowed that book from you.
Yeah, it's you actually probably should, but then you'll start beating me at Omaha 8, and then I won't have any way of making money from you, so I'm going to pretend like I lost it. you know, I'm also going to make a special mention of Raising, the chapter Raising. It's in the same book. To be honest, it's probably a better chapter than the one I picked because Raising is probably the biggest quandary players face in a split pot game.
Right.
And they're very confused about, so that's a chapter that's really going to help you out. But I think the selected chapter is a much more unique pick. A lot of books, probably most of them, completely skip discussion of levels altogether, I think.
Yeah.
And as we all know, there's a considerable difference between 1-2 no limit and 10-20 no limit. And the same thing with 2-4 limit and 20-40 limit. So some books will choose just one level and focus on it, which is great because then at least you know going in what it's going to be. But this it's a very short chapter, but it takes the reader through all of the possible levels that you play Omaha 8 and offers you extra tips on how the play changes at each level and, more importantly, how your strategy should change too. And I think that makes it, in a lot of ways, it's kind of like the utility player in your fantasy baseball. You know, but the fact is, they play a lot of things, so it actually makes you have like four extra players on your team if you have one of them. I think it's actually like having four extra Omaha books with just this one chapter, because it's really important to look at how going up in limits affects it. And obviously, this is squarely on Omaha 8, which is very probably more specific on that than Hold'em or something. But I think the concepts translate to other games as well too.
Yep, very good. And it's the mark of a good book that has stuff like that. I mean, I think you and I could probably think of like 4 or 5 books that talk about the anti-structure. Like even Super System has that. Depending on the anti-structure is how you're going to play certain stud games or whatever. And the Full Tilt Strategy Guide, those things, they all talk about, you know, if the structure is this way, this is how you got to play. So absolutely, a good book really have all of those different levels in there for you to consider when you're playing.
You know, it also helps make the rest of the book a little cleaner. Let's say just a basic Hold'em book, you know, when you're talking about concept, you almost always have to stop and go, well, this is how the concept works in tournaments, and here's how it would work in cash games, or here's how it works in limited, here's how the... And by the time you do that 80 times throughout the book, it gets very confusing. Yeah. So if you're able to find a way to just teach the concept part of the concepts, and then in the rest of the book kind of talk about the variations and the levels, it really makes it easier to learn right from, I think.
Absolutely. My next chapter, the chapter that got it all started for me is the No Limit Hold'em Doyle Brunson chapter in Super System. These days people say, oh, to win at poker you got to play aggressively. And it's so commonplace now that people say that no one actually realizes that it came from Doyle Brunson. I mean, this chapter is what taught everybody to be aggressive in poker. You know, people, now they hear it, and now they see it, and now they read about it, because it's ubiquitous, you know. But
big word.
Thank you. But really, without his chapter, people probably wouldn't have played this way. And that's why there were only a select few who always made the final table of the World Series, or who always made a living at it, because they knew you have to be aggressive. And, you know, the funny thing is, when we used to have a little home game that was different than the home game we have now. Remember, we used to play sit and goes all the time with the families,
yeah,
and
that's right.
Our wives would play. And I remember the first time that I was going to your house with my wife to play, and Jeannie loves to play sit and go hold'em, and she's still to this day, that's all she likes to play. So on our way over, I was like, well, hon, I'll give you a couple of tips, you know, if you want. And she's like, okay. I said, and I used one directly from No Limit Hold'em, and it was from Doyle's chapter. And it was, you know how people raise preflop with a big hand. If you call that raise with a small pair, or even, you know, small suited connectors, and you flop a big hand like a set or two pair, you know, and you're first to act, you bet into the raiser. And to me, you know, the antiquated philosophy of check to the raiser, you know, had always been, that's what you do when you play hold'em, when you play cards, you know, you check to the raiser, because that's what you hear on TV, that's what you see the old guys doing, that's, you know, because there's no such thing as check raising in some houses, and, you know, that kind of thing. And he puts it on its ear. He's like, no, man, you got to be aggressive, because that person who raised preflop is supposed to have a hand there. So they're supposed to have an overpair, or they're supposed to have ace-king and hit that ace on the flop, and you bet into them thinking that, you know, they're going to think you're stealing, and he's going to come back over the top, and you bust this person with a baby two-pair or with a set that they couldn't see coming, and that's what you do. And I'm telling Jean this on the way over, and sure enough, she incorporated that into her game, and she took down a couple of tournaments that night. I couldn't believe it. It was just fantastic. But to me, his chapter, even though it's as simple as play aggressively, and we all know that now, we didn't know it when we first got into poker.
Yeah.
And we didn't, you know what I mean, we didn't understand that's what you're supposed to do when you play poker until you read his chapter, or until someone else read his chapter and told you how to play. So it's just, that chapter changed it all. And I know the whole book itself changed a lot of stuff, and, you know, it's the Bible and all that, but this is like Luke 3:16 of the Bible. You know what I mean? This book is full of epiphanies for me. And I just, that chapter alone absolutely made me want to play poker, and that's why I'm here today, because of that chapter.
Excellent. Should we play some music here?
Get a little weepy there.
Yeah. All right, my third one is Bankroll Management by Christy Gazes, and this is in the book that we mentioned at the top of the bit here. That'll be published this summer sometime. It doesn't have a title quite yet, but trust us, when it's out, you'll hear from us, and And I think actually you're planning on running this chapter in our magazine.
I am. I've been given the rights to be able to run either a segment of it or the actual entire chapter, which I don't know if I should do that. But
A little teaser. Yeah. Let's not give the cow away.
Yeah, they're going to let us publish an excerpt from that chapter. And we're going to probably have one of the pros on the show, too, just talk to them about what the writing experience was like and some other stuff. Maybe even Maria Ho, who contributed a chapter to it. So we'll see what happens.
Well, certainly the one that I liked the best was the bankroll management chapter by Christy. And, this book, as you mentioned, it's a great collection of strategy and advice from top female players in the game. And obviously the advice is skewed toward the female player by design.
Right.
But there's plenty of lessons in here for players of both genders. And this particular chapter is the most honest one I've read in any book on bankroll management, and really puts in perspective how important that concept is to your game. And what happens when you go off the grid? I mean, she totally admitted, hey, I'm not perfect at this. I've messed up.
Yeah.
And this is what happened to me when I messed up, and here's how I was able to get back from it. And so, you know, there's so much ego in poker, I think, right?
Yep.
No one wants to admit that they got beat or lost or were down and out at some point or screwed up. And so when you see a player be really honest about, hey, I did mess up, and here to learn from my mistakes, I think that's really refreshing and unique.
I'm so glad, too, that you brought that up, because when I was editing the book and I made comments to Joyce, the publisher of this book, I said to her, you know, hey, this chapter is really good, and if you want someone to buy this book, you know, you should let people read some of this chapter first to get a taste, because it's that good. And it's weird that you felt the exact same way. I mean, when I was editing it, I was just like, wow, look how honest she's being. It's just, and I noticed that about a lot of the writers in this book, because they were very open about their experiences and stuff, and you don't get that very often, at least when it's negative. You know, a lot of them are always honest right. about how they won and kicked someone's butt and stole their whole stack or whatever. But, you know, in this case, she was like, you know what, I was at the top and then I was at the bottom. And here's how I kept it, you know, alive in the game, by using these bankroll. And the thing was, too, is it was a professional player who she ended up dating or getting married to or something, who taught her the strategy. So
yeah.
It's a great chapter.
Well, yeah, and then she uses other thing. The way she writes it, too, I think really helped. And we talked about thinking of terms of a winning session in terms of shoes, you know, because she loves her shoes, as everybody knows.
Yeah.
And things like that, making it, adding value to things that are in ways that people don't normally think about it, I think was really good.
Oh, well, my next chapter, and like you said earlier about Lee Jones' book, it wasn't exactly a chapter as it was sort of a subsection of the book, you know, but it was The Squeeze Play by Dan Harrington. And it actually comes in his Harrington Hold'em Volume 2, The Endgame. And the reason why is because clearly it's a concept that I can grasp. It's a concept just like, you know, just like the Stud 8 Platinum Rule, you know, if you can't scoop with this hand, consider folding it before you see another street. And same, you know, and going low. The same here. It was just something that I understood. And that what really reinforced it is, you know how the poker TV junkie I am, you know, I remember the huge squeeze play that he put on in the 2004 World Series, and everyone was just talking about it, you know, because if anybody could see his cards, you know, they call him Action Dan for a reason, because he almost never plays a hand, and when he does play a hand, you think he has a big one, and that's when he uses the squeeze play.
Yeah.
And it was a massive, massive bluff, and I was just so impressed by that. But I, at the time when I was watching it, I was still pretty much a novice, so I didn't understand what was going on. I just thought he had balls the size of North Dakota. And then when I saw it in his book, and I was like, oh, the squeeze play, that's what that was? And I'm like, oh, my God, so now I could put a name to the move, and I just totally – it just totally explains the squeeze play very simply. It's literally like one chapter on one page in this entire section of the book, because he didn't really write chapters either. He sort of wrote sections and stuff. And it was like one page. But just that concept of a very fundamental play, but it's fundamental now that you know it, but if you didn't know it, you would never think of doing it.
Right.
You know, you never really think on that kind of a level, and he helped you do that with that one play and explained it by using something that I was so impressed with early on that it just totally related to me.
Good stuff. I really did like I said at the top of this thing, that I did enjoy reading the Harrington books. I just, there are times that he got off a little far, but stuff like that was really great.
Yeah, and I totally agree, because that's why I won't mention any numbers or things like that in any of this. And that was like the one thing from Harrington's book that I could really appreciate, that I didn't have to worry about big bets and blinds and equations and formulas. And that was just, it was just really simple, and it made a lot of sense. And of course, the television references just really reinforced it for me.
All right, my next one is Pot Limit Omaha from the Full Tilt Poker, Chris Ferguson. And it is almost impossible, Chris, I think, to pick the best chapter in this book.
Yeah.
It was skillfully edited by Michael Craig. You really can't go wrong with any of them. In fact, if I was stranded on a desert island and I had to take just one poker book with me, I would definitely take this one. It just really, the chapters in it really worked for me,
yeah,
personally. But I particularly like this one because it's not only a good primer on a game that's quickly growing in popularity, as we've seen, hey, it's on Poker After Dark. It's going to be in Apes this week.
That's right.
Right, good time to read it.
Yep.
but it's very well written by Ferguson, who has always been one of my favorite players. I just like how deliberate he is, non-egotistical.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, he's a terrifically smart guy. You know, for somebody like me that doesn't like math, this is a guy that does almost everything by math. So for me to like him, you got to know it's really good. And really, there's just one or two pages in this entire chapter, and it's devoted to pocket aces and how different they play in a pot limit format, particularly in Omaha. Mm. And those two pages are I'm not saying are the only two good pages in the chapter, but it's emblematic of how the advice that he gives to the chapter. It's a concept that he's able to lay out pretty clearly, that really is one of those aha moments, those eureka things, you know? Yeah. Oh, I get it now. And you can take it, you don't have to like memorize it when you go play. It just sticks in your brain. Now I get the concept, so when I'm faced with a similar situation, even if it's not Pot Limit Omaha at some point, that lesson is going to stay with me forever. And I think that's really great.
Yeah, absolutely awesome. And you know, it's funny, I felt the exact same way about that book. It's like, between, it's like a tie between that and Super System, If I Was Stranded on an Island. You know, those two books just really, they're like the same books, but one is modernized for tournaments and the other one is cash games and right, getting you started. But I picked a chapter from that book, The Full Tilt Poker Strategy Guide Tournament Edition. And before I say what chapter it is, I do want to have the caveat that this is probably for the slower structured tournaments. I think that if you're playing in sort of a, you know, a $60 turbo, this kind of concept won't work for you. But if you're playing in the larger buy-ins with deeper stacks, this is pretty awesome. It's The Theory of Leverage by Howard Lederer. This chapter, it's got a concept which, again, I just love to have, and it's kind of like small ball, like Negreanu small ball, but not exactly. And basically, he talks about leveraging your bets against their stack sizes, and you know, and it's obviously no limit hold'em. This doesn't really work in, you know, structured betting, but a leveraged bet is in no limit hold'em when you make a smallish type bet in relation to the size of the pot that has implication on future bigger bets on later streets. It basically allows you to control the size of the pot and send an imposing message to your opponent or opponents without really risking too much of your stack. So it's kind of like small ball, but a little different. And when I play poker and I know I'm going to play in a tournament that has a larger buy-in or deeper stacks, and I know I'm playing the next day, and it's not one of those spur-of-the-moment things where I'm at the poker room and I decide to play, I always like to read this chapter before I go, because it's kind of like going to the store with a coupon.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you go to the store and, oh, here's a box of cereal for $3.50, but you have $1.50 off and you have the double coupon day. All of a sudden, you're getting a $3.50 box of cereal for 50 cents. You know, oh, by the way, you have your store card with you? Yeah, okay, well, you get it for free today. You know, all of a sudden, it's like, okay, I can bet 200 units and take a pot down of 500 units without having to risk my 10,000 units to win it, yet I'm telling them they're going to have to risk their 10,000 units with my 200 unit bet. You know, it's mind-boggling to know that you can have such power with such little effort. And, yeah. And the way he explains it, it's an excellent chapter. And again, if you're going to be playing in larger buy-ins with larger slower structures and larger stacks, this is a must read to me. And it's just the kind of chapter that really makes playing poker that much more enjoyable. And it's your meta level that you were talking about. Yeah. It's some of that meta stuff where you know how this person will react because you've played with them before, and if you make this sort of bet, they know that you're telling them, okay, I'm only betting 200 now, but I'm literally telling you my 10,000 chips can go in the middle on this hand. Are you willing to risk your stack? And it's sort of that extra level of thinking, and I just love it.
All right, my final chapter is What You Should Know to Vanquish a Pro from Phil Helmuth Presents Read 'em and Reap by Joe Navarro.
Yes.
I mean, I could not do a list like this without including a chapter from the inaugural Poker Tells book from Joe, who's just one of our, you know, gods here at Annie Up. Just a great guy, and again, one of those great teachers. He's able to convey his knowledge. I mean, he wouldn't be anywhere near as well known or sought out if he couldn't teach.
Right.
You know, there's a lot of FBI agents out there that have the same knowledge he has, but he's able to convey that in a way that people can understand it easily. And so, again, this is one of those things where the book is solid throughout, worth regular rereadings. And the chapter that I picked here doesn't dwell on spotting or concealing tells, which is why you would buy this book and why you should read this book and all of Joe's books. But what I like about this chapter is it's something that very well could happen to all of us. You know, we decide to take our big stab in a big tournament, and we sit down, and oh no, we look across the table, and yep, there's that feared pro. And now we have to realize that we have to get past our starstruck eyes and figure out how to beat this player. And without saying it in these words exactly, this chapter reminds me that we put our pants on one leg at a time, just like Phil Helmuth does. So if we psych ourselves out, then the pro wins before he even looks at his first card.
Yeah.
And I think that's important. You know, you sit down, and I know pros play this up to their advantage, and why not? You know, you sit down at the table, all of a sudden, they're the table captain, and you haven't even dealt the card yet. You know, because they know everybody is scared of them already, and they're going to play scared. So if you learn how to not play scared, if you are able to get yourself in the frame of mind of treating that person like a poker player, not a poker pro, that's a huge advantage over your other opponents at the table who probably still are starstruck and don't know what to do.
And that chapter makes it possible for me to sit down at the home game with you. Because I always psych myself out, but because I read that chapter, I know that you put on your pants one leg at a time like me, and then I should be able to compete with you at the table. So I'm glad that chapter was written.
You know, I've tried to put them on with both legs at the same time. All I've got are broken bones and fat lips from it. Someday, though, I'm going to perfect it.
Okay, well, the final chapter that I have kind of wraps it up with the meta, and it's funny when you were saying how you didn't want to Sklansky in the list because of the, you know, all the theories and all that stuff. But the fundamental theorem of poker comes from Sklansky in his book, The Theory of Poker. And it's not so much all of the stuff later on after this chapter that you know, I could relate to. It was the fact that he gets you beyond ABC poker with that one theorem. You know, if you played poker and just wanted to see what beats what, you know, you're never going to be a winning player. Whoever wins that night is just going to rotate the next week, whoever wins. And you're never going to actually dominate your game, your home game, or be a consistent winner because you're just relying on the cards. The theorem of poker really, at its simplest basic root, it states what's the best way for you to play is to act the way you would if you could see and know your opponent's cards. And once you understand what he means by that, then you can start to take your game to another level. That's when you start asking yourself, what does that person think I have? And what do I think they have? And what are they trying to tell me they have? And why are they telling me that? You start thinking like that just by the way he talks about this theorem. So it's got nothing to do with numbers and theories and everything. It's just this one basic concept. It's like the grandfather of the metagame. You know, people talk about meta now. It's just this word that is now starting to come up a lot when you hear him playing on TV and whatever. But even, you know, back then when he wrote this book, this was basically, you know, transcending ABC poker and teaching you that you need to play as if you need to play, or how would you play if you knew what they were holding, and then act accordingly. And also, if they knew what you were holding, or you have to tell them what they're thinking that you have, and then act the opposite way. You know, so it just makes you think differently about, and this is what gets back to, you don't play the card, you play the person. This right. is kind of that all in a nutshell. And it, just for me, it just made me think differently about poker. It wasn't like, I have a really good hand, I'm betting my hand. No, I have to bet his hand because I need to know how much he's willing to call, or how much, you know, how big his hand really is, and whether or not I can get him off it, or whether or not my hand's bet. You know, it's just a different way of thinking. And that, to me, even though Sklansky's known for his numbers and his incredible concepts that I'll never understand, my head's not big enough for my brain to grow that much to fit in. And I just really appreciated the fact that he contributed something to poker that will always make you think differently, and that's what helped made me who I am as a poker player.
Absolutely. Great. Good stuff.
Yeah, this was pretty cool. I mean, again, it makes me rethink, oh my God, I got to read that book that you were talking about now. You know what I mean? It's just, you can never read too much, I don't think. And that was the start of my story, too, was I hate those people who were like, I never read a poker book in my life.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, well, you're stupid then. Because, you know what, there's so much out there that could help you, whether you want to be, you know, you don't need to, it's not a badge of honor that you've never read a book. Why not learn from someone else who has already gone down that path for you? You know, why not learn from them? And I just think it's silly to not invest $20 in a book that will easily pay for itself, you know, with one thing that you learn from it. And I think reading in poker is fundamental.
Boom, 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 the more you know.
This is Noah Brunson, and you're listening to Annie Up.
All right, our hand of the week comes from David.
Okay.
And from Colorado Springs, Colorado.
Wow, Annie Up, soon to be there.
Yeah, yeah, that's out where Mork and Mindy are from, right?
Yeah.
Or was it Boulder?
Nanu. I think it was Boulder, but whatever.
The Air Force Academy is from Colorado Springs, right?
I guess. I don't know.
The Falcons. The Mighty Falcons.
The show is long enough without going through where everyone is from in Colorado.
Oh, all right. So he sent us in a couple hands, and so we're going to use the second one, which is more a hand of the week worthy, in my humble opinion.
Okay.
And he says the hero here recently won a $1,500 plus person multi-table tournament.
Wow.
And was now squandering the winnings by playing stakes he shouldn't have been.
That's no easy feat to win a tournament like that.
Happens all the time. All right. He says the hero is playing on PokerStars at a 6 max no limit hold'em table.
Okay.
One seat's currently empty, though, so we're five-handed. Stakes are 50 cents, $1. And the hero had bought in for $60. Most of the players are between 50 and 150.
Okay.
Hero had just doubled up on a cooler hand, full house versus full house. Oh, I hate those. which was the hero's goal. You know, it's amazing to me how many people don't have a goal of doubling up. That really would be a very good goal. You know, I don't know if the goal is to double up on the cooler hand, though, because that's a little tougher to do.
That's hard to do.
But we're happy for the hero, nonetheless. And the hero was ready to leave. But because the hero used to be a mega fish, was that the movie with Debbie Gibson? he used to just follow advice and books brainlessly. Oh, boy. We just did the whole show on reading poker books.
Yeah, but we didn't say read them brainlessly. So, yeah.
Because of all this, he didn't want to get up yet. Hiro was just on the button, so he's going to wait until the blinds come around again, which is a polite thing to do, supposedly. How many of us have done that? Hey, I'll play until the blinds come around.
That's not polite. Means, that's because you want to see as many free hands as you can before you have to pay for another one. It's going to end up being polite.
Yeah, but we always say what it means when here, I'll do a poker translation for you. When you say, I'm going to play till my blind comes around, what you're saying is, I want to give every opportunity to go broke before I leave today. That's what it means.
And I want to stand up immediately when the blind gets there so the guy next to me gets pissed off because now he's in a big blind, didn't want to be for that hand.
And then the next guy gets up too, and you know, goes around.
And the all game right, breaks.
So, all right, so we got the situation here. He's playing above his level,
means,
comfortable level.
Yeah, right.
He got lucky on a double up. He should be getting up, but he's not. Next hand, a new person sits down, who we're calling the villain. In middle position, posts his blind, which the hero recognizes as a fish move, not waiting until it was his blind. Hey, maybe he was in a rush.
Maybe he's wants to just get into the action right away and not wait.
Maybe his little poker supercomputer said, hey, these people are prime for the pickings.
Yeah, obviously we're playing outside of our comfort level, so maybe he recognized that by seeing what you normally play on his, I don't know, his set mining show. I don't know what those damn programs are called. I have no idea, but Poker X Factor or something, I don't know.
All right, so now we're at a full six-person table because of this.
All right.
The new guy villain... has $97 in front of him, raises to $3.
Okay.
And it folds to us. I guess we don't have a position. Where are we? Oh, yeah, I guess he just said we were on the button, right?
Right.
Folds around to us, and we have the King of Hearts, King of Diamonds.
Oh, wow.
Two Red Thrones.
I'll raise Red Thrones. I'll raise to, I don't know, 10? 12? What do you think?
Let's see. Well, we had somebody answer 5,100 and made it 3. Yeah, I mean, you're supposed to do, if we follow brainlessly the advice in the books, it'd be a 3x raise on top of that, so that'd be $12.
No, three times 3 is 9. Right, he raised a 3, so we would make it
times 4, yeah.
We went times 4 is 12.
See, that's why math is not on my list of chapters.
And I'm so glad that you do the books for the company, buddy.
Hey, it's all automatic, man.
We're all going to prison. All right, so I would say 10
yeah,
to 12.
I guess,
I don't know
all
what
right, technically it'd be 9, and then I don't like 9 for some reason. I'd make it 10, but since it's online, I'd make it $9.99. How's that?
Very good.
All right, well, the hero raises to 12. And that leaves his stack at 108.
All right.
And it folds around to the villain who calls.
Huh.
All right. So heads up going to the flop. Stacks are $88 and $108 respectively.
All right.
Pot is $25.50. Flop is the Queen of Diamonds, Seven of Diamonds, Deuce of Diamonds, and our hero gets points for putting the cards in sequential order so I don't have to reorder them.
Okay.
All right, so three diamonds. Remember, we had the King of Hearts and the King of Diamonds.
Okay.
And I believe our villain is first to act and leads out for $15 into our pot of $25.50.
Hmm. That's a pretty good bet. I mean, you got a bet here, you know. I mean, if you showed because originally he showed strength raising first, so that's very interesting. I wonder what kind of hand he has. He could have like ace queen with the ace of diamonds, betting like that, or he could have nothing. He could have aces too, which is scary, ace of diamonds. God, I don't know. I think I might raise here. I don't know because I mean you can't be afraid of a set. Every, you know what I mean, just because there's one bet,
yeah,
you know, and you can't be afraid of a flush at this point because the odds of the flopping the flush like that are, you know, very rare. So I don't know. Maybe I'll see. It's tough though if you just call and a diamond comes. Yeah, you'll have your king high flush, but I don't know. Man, I think I'd raise. I think I'm raising, Scott. I think I'm gonna make it like $40.
Yeah, the interesting thing here, I think, is that the villain's kind of got a free shot to bet here, and that's probably the wrong way of saying it, but, you know, he's got a continuation bet. If you don't have any diamonds, I mean, where are you going to try to represent them? So, I mean, the $15 makes sense. We obviously have an overpair here, and we re-raised, and we have the diamond draw. The only thing I'm worried about raising here is that the villain is really smart. He might repop us thinking that we don't have the diamonds and now putting the fear in us, and then we got to play a bigger pot. But I think I'm fine doing that with the overpair and the diamond draw.
And it kind of gets back to what we were saying, with what I was saying with the No Limit Hold'em chapter, that, you know, if this guy is putting you on a really big hand and he's now flopped the really big hand like you talked about, then maybe he is betting into you, hoping you'll raise with aces or kings, and he's got a set of something. So it's pretty scary, but I also think that if you did make it 40 to go, you might get your answer. I mean, he may smooth call, who knows, but really, he could be betting out to avoid the flush, too. He could have, like, ace-queen and not the ace of diamonds, and he could be just trying to make you pay to make a flush or something. So I don't know. It's tough. It's a tough hand. It's a really weird flop. If there was three suits, it'd be a perfect flop because queen seven deuce. I mean, that's the absolute worst possible flop possible. Far as, you know, making a hand. So, I don't know. I feel like I really feel like a call here doesn't really help us. I feel like I need to make some sort of raise here. So I don't know, maybe $40.
Well, I guess what I would think about is do I just want to call and kind of, I don't want to say conceal the strength of my hand, because we very well could be behind here, but are we going to get more, if we think we're ahead here, are we going to get more out of the villain by just calling here and seeing what he does on the turn and then maybe make that a raise? Or do we want to not take the shot of a diamond coming, which we hope would help us but might not hurt, or might hurt us?
Yeah.
So I guess I don't think they're, the only wrong move here, I think, is folding.
Yeah, I don't like a fold.
I think the flop is good.
Yeah.
I mean, if we're up against a set, we've got a lot of outs against that. And if we're up against anything else, we're most likely ahead, or we got outs. I mean, it's not a really, it looks like a dangerous board, but I don't think it's too dangerous for us.
Right. The only hand that we can't beat is ace, a diamond.
Right, a made ace.
Yeah. But other than that, I mean, yeah. So I don't mind raising here, because I think that there are hands that can beat us if the right turn card comes. And I don't want that turn card to come at his price. I want it to come at mine. So I probably would have bet 15 or 17 or 18 if it was my bet to make and he had checked to me. But now that he's bet, I'm comfortable getting a little more money in the pot. So I think I would raise and see what he does.
Okay. You know what? I'm going to call just because I'm that kind of player.
Okay.
And try to get more money on the turn. But I certainly would not punish anybody for raising here. So, I mean, what are you going to make it, like 45, 50?
Yeah, I was saying about 40 or so.
Okay, 40. All right, well, our hero's thinking is that we're not sure whether this is a good flop or a bad flop for us. I was thinking ace jack of diamonds and queen queen are the hands that scare him the most, with ace jack being scarier. I really, I'm having trouble believing somebody's going to bet the ace high flush here. Hmm. Sometimes you do that to be crafty, but I don't know. I think you got a better shot at getting money out of somebody by checking here and letting them either check behind and then betting on the turn, or taking a stab at it and then stringing along. I'm really not worried about the flopped ace flush right now.
No, I'm definitely not worried about it. I am worried about the ace of diamonds being in his hand.
Oh, certainly the ace of diamonds, but yeah, not an ace of diamonds and another diamond.
Right, exactly. Yeah, I'm not worried about that.
All right. Well, so after our hero thinks about it, he makes the call.
Okay.
Stacks are now 73-93. Pots 55-50. The turn is the nine of hearts. So our board now is queen of diamonds, seven of diamonds, deuce of diamonds, nine of hearts. And the villain leads out for 33 into our pot of 55-50.
Wow. That's two strong bets into us. You know, we're not going anywhere. The funny
I guess
thing
this is an argument against calling.
Yeah, I was going to say, the funny thing is if we didn't if we had raised, we would have probably raised almost that amount and found out what was going on.
Yeah, because we emboldened him to take another shot at us here by just calling.
Yeah.
Because the diamond didn't get there if he puts us on a diamond draw.
It's hard for me to put this guy on a diamond draw now. And I think that I might be comfortable calling now, believe it or not. It's weird. Now that there's only one card to come, I'd be more comfortable to just call here and keep the pot respectable without bloating it and forcing my whole stack in there. So,
yeah,
I think that I would just call now.
I'm going to do the same thing.
I mean, let's put him on a range here. I mean, it sounds to me like he's got some sort of queen in his hand, and that's good for us. We have kings, but I really don't know. But really, it could be a diamond in his hand and a queen, like queen jack with the queen of diamonds. But that's not the type of hand he would raise, what you would think, especially just sitting down at a six-handed table. But I don't know. I put him on some sort of queen. And I'm not even sure he has a diamond in his hand, but maybe he does. But just betting again with only a draw seems odd to me. Seems like he's got some sort of made hand now.
I would think so, too.
All right, so I'm just going to call. I'm happy with calling.
All right, so we all agree the hero calls as well. We go to the river. Stacks are 40 and 60 now. Pot is 121.50.
Right.
And the river is the four of spades. So our final board is queen of diamonds, seven of diamonds, deuce of diamonds, nine of hearts, four of spades, and the villain bets his last $40.
Well, we can't fold.
Yeah.
and that's the other thing too is, you know, if I remembered that Dale and Guy only had 40 left in front of him, you know, maybe I do just shove on him on the turn. I don't know, but I can't fold. That's $40 and it's 120 in the pot. Now it's 160. I'm getting 4-1 on a call with an overpair. You know, and it's not like this guy shoved on me earlier. And the four-card flush didn't get there, so I would have to just call. I can't fold.
You know, what's interesting about the turn now that we think about it again is that, if he has his beat, that $40 is going in regardless.
Right.
Sometime, right?
Right.
If not, if we raise him on the turn, he's going to call us. If not, he's going to bet it like he did on the river. So this is one of those situations where if we should just raise on the turn and got it in because it's going to get in anyhow, and if he's just bluffing or whatever, then we get him out and don't give him a shot to improve on the river, right?
Right, right. Exactly.
Yeah, I really feel bad that I didn't take into account. I mean, that's even funnier, too, is that that our hero here has been giving us the stack sizes all along.
I know, and we're not even...
And I'm just reading them. Oh, okay, all right, great. And I'm not thinking about it. That's exactly, I think, that was the problem. I think we gave them a free look at the, quote-unquote, free look at the river.
The river, yeah, that was a mistake. Not that the four spades probably helped him, but...
No,
right.
In fact, yeah, but what happens now if it, if it was the... I don't know. You know, something that really helped him. You know, maybe he's pocket fours. I mean, I guess it could help.
Yeah,
you know?
Right. Yeah, you're right. You shouldn't have given him that. You should have just shoved on the turn thinking of what that stack size was, so... okay, so I called. I'm assuming he calls, otherwise...
Yeah, all right. So the hero says at this point, we're thinking, quote, man, if I call this and lose, not only do I lose all the money from the previous cooler hand, I'll be down from what I started with. Of course, now I see that was total fish talk. You shouldn't take into account things like this when deciding what the best play is on one particular hand. But nonetheless, we call.
Okay.
The villain turns over to the queen of hearts, six of hearts, top pair weak kicker.
Wow. So we basically destroyed this guy, right?
Absolutely.
And that's weird that the guy would raise $3 with queen six. That's not the hand I put this guy in at all. I really thought it was like ace queen. But $3, calls a re-raise to $12 with queen six suited, which makes a big deal. And then bets out on a three diamond board when he hits top pair, no kicker. And when he gets called, see, now that's where our raises, I think, would have maybe gotten this guy to say, holy cow, I better get out of this hand. You know, and we gave this guy literally, and that four could have been a six.
Yeah.
And he could have made an easy two pair and beaten us. So, all the more reason to shove on the turn. But again, I would have raised on the flop. Like I said, when he bet 15, I'd have made it 40 or 45. And then, we'll see if this guy really wants to get it all in. And if he does, I think at that point I have no problem calling because I have the king of diamonds and an overpair.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then we would have seen that this guy was just absolutely horrible.
Yeah, again, it's a scary board, but it's a protected board for our hand, you know.
It and you can see the other guy's side of it once he's into the hand, why he's betting the way he is, because he thinks we have the draw, which we did. But he didn't realize we had the overpair, too. So
we had a draw with benefits, though.
Yeah. Oh, man. That's crazy, though, that he's going to leave, and now he doubles up again, essentially, or whatever.
All right, Dave, we appreciate you sending a hand end of the weekend, and we are going to send you a download of the Poker Hand Breakdown Pro Hand History Analysis Program for single or mixed games. That comes from the great folks at element26.net. And a final reminder to send your hands of the week or anything you want to talk about on the podcast to podcast@annieupmagazine.com.
I want to thank all of the poker authors out there who wrote all those awesome poker books for us to talk about today. It was really a cool show. I thought that was something we haven't... It's kind of getting back to our roots with a little bit of instruction and a little peek into our lives.
Absolutely.
I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We will see you at the tables.
Ante Up is a production of AnteUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnteUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnteUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.